I want you to imagine the future in motion where all cars are green, bicycles rule, and public transit is fast, frequent, and fun. It's a world where mobility is sustainable and accessible to everyone, where energy is clean and abundant, renewable and affordable, where communities aren't just smart, they're intelligent and nurturing places to live. So come along and explore that world with me on this EV World Future in Motion podcast.
Yeah.
How are you doing, sir?
Good.
I should probably say Gates Ihnen.
Ah, very good. Mir geht es gut, danke.
You're quite welcome. I only speak a modicum of German. Ein kleines bisschen,
but it sounds good.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I was actually born in Germany, not far from Kassel.
Yeah. Ah, from Kassel. Okay.
Yeah.
So up there. Okay.
Yeah, so
I studied in Würzburg.
So technically I'm a Hessian.
Ah, you're a Hesse. Yeah. You know, they speak a different dialect, the Hesse Bubble, yeah.
Well, I could not tell you that, because I left there when I was 1 year old, so I...
1 year old, okay.
Yeah, so I didn't have a chance to pick up too much German, other than Dada and Mama.
funny.
Yep. Anyway, thank you for taking the call. I think this is really exciting, what you guys are doing. This is being recorded. Are you okay with that?
Yes, I'm okay with that.
Okay,
yes.
Very good. And just as I think, I don't know if you saw the email or not, but
yes,
Megan had me listed as a Wall Street journalist.
Yeah.
I can only dream. Anyway.
I dream, okay.
Yeah. So this is for EV World. And so what I am doing is, at the encouragement of a friend of mine, Jigar Shaw, I went and bought one of the Fiat 500Es out of California. It was on lease.
Okay.
And so I bought it. Pardon?
$99 lease?
No, unfortunately. I think they had some of them that were that way, yes.
But there's
a bunch of these available every month. And I was looking for an electric car. I've been writing about this for 20 years. But never had an opportunity to actually own one because they were just, out of my league. So when I found that I could buy one for less than $10,000, I took advantage of that. And as a result of that, Jigar suggested, he says, I know of a couple of companies that are doing subscription services. One of them there in your area, Southern California. And I think it's called Borrow Baby is the name of the company. And
Borrow,
there's one
yeah,
out in,
Borrow.
Yeah, then there's one out in the D.C. area that he was aware of. So I said, why don't you take a look at that? So I started taking a look at it. And I thought, well, this might be an interesting business model to explore. And then I found out that not long ago, Rivian introduced said that they're going to not sell their cars. They were going to subscribe them. And then I saw your announcement, and then coincidentally, I don't know if you saw this, but Henrik Fisker just announced over the weekend that he's going to be offering his cars on a subscription program too. So apparently this is becoming a trend.
That is a trend, yeah.
So,
but it is to be expected, because obviously the core issue is that we are dealing with quite expensive electric cars.
And yep.
What you correctly said, most people cannot afford them. So if we want to do something good and get more people into driving electric cars, then we have to kind of make people aware of what the big benefits on electric cars are, which is obviously a lower cost of operation, and that's something you can capture better if you have a subscription model.
Right. Because
then you boil it down to the essence that somebody just looks at the monthly payment and doesn't focus on a very high acquisition cost.
Yes.
So that's why I think it makes all these companies are arriving at the same logic that I arrived at when I was with Faraday, and I had to solve for the very expensive car and how to make it more sellable.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because you came out of Faraday Future, which is sort of the, I don't know what their status is now. It's kind of been up and down. But so you were originally with BMW, is that correct?
Yes, I spent my career in very brief is I spent about 20 years with BMW, and I was in engineering, sales, and financial services. Primarily, became their CFO, and I was almost 8 years their CFO. And then I moved to Deutsche Bank. I was 8 years a banker, a CFO of Deutsche Bank. And then I came to California to fix Faraday Future, which then regretfully didn't work because of the Chinese owner. Yeah.
That would be the course of another copy. I would love to sit down with you and find out, you know, what went not enough money or just bad management or engineering or what. But we'll save that for another time. How's that? So
I can tell you there's an interesting story in the sense that just only to put that on the list. There's an interesting story of those Chinese-American companies and how these two cultures clash always after a certain point in time, right? And these companies don't work. Most of the EV businesses here in California are Chinese-funded in some way or another. And it normally takes 1.5 to 2 years, and then these cultural issues become and misunderstandings become a real issue to run these companies. And that has been now, I've observed it in repeated cases. So if you want to take a note, that's quite an interesting story. When you talk about why they don't work, there are deeply cultural issues between the Western and the American business culture.
That's interesting. So how did Canoe come about? I mean, first of all, it's a different name for a company. So how did that come about?
So the company itself, there were a lot of Faraday people in the time where Faraday was basically bankrupt and was going down. And obviously there were a lot of the teams in Faraday with different groups meeting and thinking about whether they can do a car themselves. And there were different groups, and they were meeting in backyards and were thinking about, but obviously most of them are engineers. Some of them are marketing people. And the question was always, you know, how do you get really funding to, because it's a high amount of funding. And, I was part of two of these groups that were meeting on weekends, and nine of us finally ended up saying, okay, we will do this. And I flew to Hong Kong and visited some investors that I know, and I rounded up some money and came back, and we started in December of 17. It was the nine of us, and we then obviously started to bring in engineers and designers and, you know, understood the car building process quite well. And started in December. In January, we had our first seating bug, and then it moved quite rapidly. The initial name of the company was eVelocity. The reason was that within one day, we needed to register a company to get the bank accounts and funding. And as you know, in today's world, most of the two-letter, three-letter, four-letter, and five-letter names are already taken, right? So it's very difficult to register a name. So in that evening before creating eVelocity, I came up with this name. It was funny because we wanted to be about the city. We wanted to be about electric cars, about the city. That was going to be our focus. And then we wanted to be fast. So I used the Spanish word veloz and the word city. And then, you know, I had velocity.
Right.
But velocity was already taken. And then by putting an E in front of the veloz, it came up with e-velocity. And it sounded like electricity and something like that. And then we, after a cheap bottle of red wine, decided to go with the velocity. And that's how we registered the name the next day. But of course, now you can imagine a Chinese that has to say the word a velocity that generally goes wrong. Yeah. And
right.
We always knew that we wanted to change the name. And then we did the classical, you know, we had actually two marketing agencies that, you know, they all told us how great of brand names they had created. And then we, funny enough, we also found a rapper group here in LA that came out of the hood, and they also participated in name, and we asked all our employees to provide names. So we ended up with a list of 400 names.
Oh
Most
my.
of them were already taken. Yeah.
Yeah.
Many names were things. We wanted to have something that kind of associated with California, kind of, you know. To, we had learned from the marketing agency that today it doesn't really matter anymore that the name needs to be descriptive of what you do or associated to what you do.
Right.
Most of the electric car companies had decided to, like Faraday or Tesla, to use names of people that had, you know, worked in
right.
creating electricity.
Pioneers in electrical, electric field.
So we didn't want to be Electrical or Lucid, as an example. These are all, yeah, then there were all these companies that declared that they're the new mobility, like NIO and Next and things like that. We also decided that that wouldn't be a cool brand name. And I must say, all these exercises were quite unsuccessful in the sense that, you know, either we found good names and they were taken, or there was just no good proposals made. And then, to be honest, I was on the beach in Mexico on my Christmas vacation, and I saw a canoe, and that's when I thought, man, this is an international global means of transportation.
Right.
Everybody, every culture knows it. It rides very smooth. The associations people have with the canoe are all positive. It's about nature. It's about quiet. It's about sustainable. And canoe is the same word all over in many different languages and cultures. It's a very good name.
Mm.
The marketing agency had told us that for millennia, it's very important that you can transfer the name into a verb. So it's into an activity. So we have to Uber, right?
Right.
And
Lyft,
therefore, we had to canoe, and that fit also perfect. And then the name also needs to be able to describe a tribe, which are the canoers, right? So in that sense, that was important from that I had learned from the marketing agency for modern name. And then they said, look, today you ask a person and say, I have an Apple, and it's more likely that people are going to think about that you have a computer or a phone than that you're actually going to have a fruit, right?
Right.
And that's why the association of the name doesn't matter anymore. It's over time, people will understand that a canoe is a car and that a canoe is an electric car.
Sure.
And this is how branding works. And yeah, and then funny enough, I found out that the name was already taken, but by a company in Switzerland, that engineering company that had just acquired Canoe, which was a German engineering company. And I traveled to Switzerland and convinced our friend to give us the rights to the name. And he then, after some Swiss smart negotiations, we finally managed to get the name.
Wow, what a story. That's a story all of by itself. Okay, so how did... So Faraday was working on what would you call it? It's not a sedan. It's probably maybe more crossover, SUV?
It's a crossover, yeah. I would say it was a classical crossover, but very expensive, high-end positioned in the luxury market.
Right. So developing a van seemed like just a complete switch, which, you know, I can see the merit of that. And I get apparently Volkswagen does too with the, the Buzz. So how did that come about then? How long did it take you guys to sit around and have a few glasses of wine and come up with that idea?
Yeah. There was actually, you know, and when we started to discuss, we wanted to make a car that's relevant and a car that is for the young people in urban cities and that means something to them.
Right.
And so that was our starting point. And then we looked at the concept, and obviously today, you know, what we see in these cities is we're driving around with the most ridiculous car you can drive around in cities, which are these SUVs.
Right. Yep.
And if you understand the essence of an SUV, you know, I did some extensive research about this topic of what are the drivers for people buying SUVs, and it's certainly the flexibility in the space that you have. You want to have enough space for people, and you want to have enough space for your sports and for your cargo and for your luggage and things like that.
Right.
And that's why we buy this optionality. And in the past, actually, this topic has been a quite recurring topic. Our grandparents drove around with this big station wagons,
Yes,
right? That
yes.
was and the wagoneers and these type of cars. And then we moved into driving around with minivans, right? That also fulfilled this need of transporting people and goods. The main issue that minivans though had was that they were reputationally damaging to you. It was not a sexy car, and that's why we today have this craziness that people drive SUVs, because SUVs, give you a better
Or
reputation, seen
if you're here in the
cool.
Midwest, they drive F-150 four-door pickups,
Yes,
and
pickups. Yes,
it's, yeah.
yes.
Go
But
down
in
my
cities,
block here, and about half of the vehicles, or three-quarters of the vehicles in the driveway, are all those now.
no, yeah,
Yeah.
and but we were looking more into the cities,
Yep.
right, into the
Yes.
large mega cities, and these SUVs that people drive into the cities, were the clue that what people really want, and we as humans are kind of funny. 90% of the time we drive and sit in these cars alone. Yeah, but if we go four times to play golf a year, then we want to have a car that fits four golf bags.
Right.
And if you go one time a year skiing, we want to have a car that accommodates your skiers. And if you go surfing every other weekend, you want to have a car that you can put your surfboard on. And for this optionality, we are paying a lot of money, right? Because we
Yes.
make an expensive acquisition or we commit to a 3-year lease. And just to have this optionality, most of the time the car is parked. That's about 90% of the time the car is parked. And then within the 10% people really use the car, another 90% you're driving by yourself, right?
Yes.
So this optionality we buy seems to have a very high value to us. So it was clear to us, number one, the car needed to offer a lot of space, right, to transport people and goods, to be a relevant solution that replaces the SUV. And then because the SUV is the biggest market right now. And then the second thing was it needs to have a command sitting position, because what made people move from these station wagons to minivans was mainly the safety feeling you have about what we call the command sitting position. You sit higher, you sit
Yes.
above the traffic, and that gives you a secure feeling, which the SUV also fulfills. You just sit higher, you sit above the traffic, and gives you an inherent safety feeling. And these were the two drivers. And then the other phenomenon we looked at, the ride-hailing phenomenon, the Uber and Lyft and Didi, is quite interesting. And there's no purpose-built car for ride-hailing. Yeah, you're generally squeezed into the back seat of a small car by
Yes.
now, right?
Yes.
And that's not really made for ride-hailing. So combining all of this, we decided that we wanted to create last argument, the autonomous world, in which you're not gonna just sit in the car looking at the driving direction, but now you can eventually use the car as a living room and as a working space and as a social space.
Yes.
And that led to this design, and that led to say, okay, the benefit of an electric drivetrain is you can put everything in the floor of the car, thereby creating a big space on top. Also, it's a very small car overall, which is good for cities. The amount of space you see that need in a combustion engine car for technology is about almost 40% of the car, which an electric car really goes down to about 25% of the space you need for the electric. Yeah. And therefore, this is the concept that we then decided to develop and said, let's really push everything into the floor of the car. And that's why our skateboard is so flat. And let's build a car that has enough space for people, and it's also purpose-built for ride-hailing, so very comfortable for the paying passenger. And that came out. This is how cars, in our view, will look in the future.
Right,
And that's
yeah.
kind of why we call it the post-SUV solution for cities.
Perfect. Now, what are some of your specifications in terms of performance of this? And the other issue, of course, is as you eliminate the nose of a vehicle, you also compress the crash crumple zone of the vehicle. So, which was always a concern with the VW bus. You're sitting right there, above the bumper. So how does kind of some of those issues come about?
Well, the truth is, our car will be completely crash safety compliant. And what people always forget, they see these long noses, but you have an engine in these long noses. You have very hard stuff. You have a steering wheel that comes to you. You have a whole dashboard that will hit you, right?
Right.
So our design is made you, our passenger doesn't really sit as, you know, at the VW bus. The problem was you were sitting in front of the, or on top of the front wheel, right?
Yes.
Our driver still sits behind the front wheel, right?
Okay.
So we have enough of a crumble zone, but the benefit of our crumble zone is only crumble zone, right? There's nothing coming. You see, we have no dashboard coming at you.
Right.
With our steer-by-wire system, we don't have a fixed pole, a metal pole that may hit you, right?
Yes.
We have, and we have an open space in front of you, and that space has only been decided for one purpose. And this one purpose it has been designed for is just crash. And therefore, we have a so much better crash performance than a combustion engine vehicle that has an engine in front of you, where all this material has to go somewhere,
yes,
and not hit you. And therefore, honestly, it was very uncomplicated to get a 5-star rating on that car.
Fabulous.
Very safe.
Yeah, performance-wise, you're looking, what, 200 miles?
Yep.
Generally, that's where we're at now is the minimum.
250 miles. So our view was for cities. And again, you know, we made the decision that our cars is going to be for the mega cities of the world. Our view is that the electric movement will come about in cities. That's where it's more urgently needed. If you live in the Midwest, it's obviously not, I don't think an electric car is necessarily in the near future a good solution for long distances you have to drive in the Midwest. So our focus was the city.
Yes.
Yeah. So we felt that we had to create a car for cities. And therefore we felt that charging and things like that, that 250 miles would be sufficient as a range. That's what the car has. And second thing is we're not going to drive high speed in cities. You'll certainly have some highway, but you're not going to be German Autobahn. So the car should have a good drag coefficient, but doesn't need to be best in class. And then we also altered our whole system. You know, we're not about top end speed, and we're not about acceleration. Anyway, an electric car always will have a good acceleration, but we're not competing for the fastest 0 to 60. I think these are all not relevant performance criteria for a city vehicle. It needs to be, our view was more, it needs to be reliable. It needs to have 250 miles. And that's why our whole battery management system and all our setup is built for safety and for durability and for quality in cities and usability in cities. And it's less built to be a sports car.
Yeah, what is the charge time typically on the, I assume you'll have some type of DC fast charge.
Yes. Yeah, we have a charge time. The usual criteria now is this 20 to 80% of the battery.
Right.
And that will be done in about 26 minutes.
Okay. Terrific. Now, so let's talk about and I should point out when you're talking about, you know, speed and things like that, I can absolutely agree with you. Since driving my Fiat 500, which is just strictly a city car. And I am constantly amazed that when I, you know, I'll drive to a meeting and I'll get to the meeting, when I turn it off, it tells me what my average speed was. My average speed is like 18 miles an hour. It's like, you know, we just don't realize, you know, in a congested city, what the actual travel time, you know, and speeds are much lower than I think than what most of us think. Okay, so let's talk about the subscription model. Now, I understand from an email you sent me earlier that it was a little bit of a struggle on your part to convince people that this was the direction to go.
Yes. Well, I had developed a subscription model already, and I must say the benefit I always had, you know, I had this career between the car company and the banker, right?
Yes.
So I have a very good understanding of how financial markets work and how leases and loans. There was a long time at the captive finance company in the U.S. of BMW, and I built up this captive finance for BMW. So I totally understand leases. I understand monthly payments. I understand residual values. I understand car depreciation. And at the same time, I also understand the car industry and technology around it. So I really sat down, and the first thing is that there were subscription models in place, right? since years, and they all are not very successful because you will see that the subscription price is very high,
yes,
generally, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
And that makes them. And the problem is the key issue you got to resolve, to be honest, is the new car depreciation.
Yes.
And what has happened in the car industry over time is that because manufacturers are constantly have overcapacity in the factories, they tend to push new cars into the market way beyond the natural demand for new cars, right?
Yes.
And that's why you find all these discounted leases. And, you know, we had played the game at BMW also, right? So you offered discounted leases and you offered rebates and you offered, you know, all kinds of attractive financing or purchase solutions, because at the end there was not enough demand for new cars. So you had to go into the next group, which was the normal buyers for used cars, and entice them to buy a new car if you wanted to move more metal, right? And dealers became pretty good at this game, and you know, all the advertising and all the games that are being played around residual inflation and things like that. So for because of that effect, the used car market got hit very hard, yeah, and used car values started to drop very quickly, yeah. Then there was an oversupply, obviously, of relatively young used cars coming out of 24-month leases or 36-month leases.
Yes.
And again, now as many used car buyers were pulled into the new car segment, there wasn't enough demand. And that's why we have this almost 60% depreciation of a vehicle within the first 3 years, right?
Well, that's,
and
yeah,
if you're
that's,
now...
That's, yeah, I'm sorry. That, yeah. That's what I experienced with my car. Yes, absolutely.
Exactly, right? So now if you build a business that, let's say, creates a subscription, yeah, you now need to amortize 60% of the value of a car in the first 3 years. And if you want to make a profit and cover all the other expenses, yeah, you end up at these high subscription prices, yeah, if you want to make a profit. It's just because you are now dealing with this very high depreciation that's the market given on these cars, right? And you have to cover that cost. And the truth, though, is if you go away from looking at the car in that sense, but look at the car, how long is the usable life of a car? Currently, the average age of the vehicle park in the United States is 11 years.
Okay.
So the usable life of a car is probably around 15 years, right? So,
yes.
And it's quite interesting to see that normally, if you think about the depreciation a car should suffer, it should be a straight line over 12 years, something like that, right? And if you now straight line depreciate a car over 12 years, now you make obviously the amortization piece and the depreciation piece in a subscription model much less expensive. And therefore, the first change that we did, which is, I think, a significant change to any other subscription point out, is we have to avoid a secondary market pricing for used cars, because then your auditors are going to tell you that you have to depreciate 60% of your vehicle value in the first 3 years. And by never selling the vehicle, there will be no fair market value in the marketplace.
Wow.
And therefore, your auditor will allow you to depreciate the vehicle straight line over 12 years, like any type of equipment you might have in a factory that you're using for your business, or the way, for example, airplanes are depreciated over their usable life, right?
Brilliant, yes.
And this opened up now the opportunity, but this is the rule. You cannot ever sell. Once you sell, and once you create a fair market value, because your auditor is forced to, if there is a fair market value for your asset, to force it to depreciate down to a fair market value. And if you never create a fair market value for a used canoe, then you have this accounting benefit, and once you have this accounting benefit, a subscription model becomes competitive, because you're really now charging the customer for what he really uses and not for some market aberration.
Yes.
And that was the essence of what we invented, and I don't think there's any other subscription model, and that's the problem when people buy cars. Like if you wrote me, when you will buy cars, you will be subject to this depreciation. So generally, that's why some subscription companies try to go with used cars, right? Because
yes,
then obviously you at least solve for the initial significant depreciation that a new car has. The problem only is when you go to used cars, then maybe your clients might not be as happy, or a certain segment of clients may not be as happy with the vehicle, and they may not be interested in used cars, and then maybe you tend to get not the best clients into this type of subscription.
Right, understood, yes.
So that's the essence of our subscription model versus anything what's out there. Yeah, so we will have less of a depreciation, and we will have to be able to manage. And then obviously we built the product now, and that was interesting, our designers and engineers. If you build cars for a one-time sale, it generally will pick materials that are probably going to last you a 3-year or 5-year warranty. You're probably going to look materials that look good in day one, yeah, that deteriorate probably. That's how you save costs. And once you own, and once I told our engineers and designers, we are going to own and operate these cars as equipment for 12 years, their mindset changed. So that's why, for example, if you look at our car, our front seats look like chairs, right? Why? Because we want to be able to remove these chairs if they deteriorate too much, right? Our back seat looks like a bench, like your sofa at home. We want to be able to refurbish this sofa by just recovering it with new material. We went into rather airline and public transportation materials that last longer.
Oh,
yes. We created a very simple design, for example, our pack boards. So if the inside gets excess wear and tear, you know, we just have to change these pack boards. Yeah, we don't have to change a whole door panel. So the car was designed with this purpose of line that we have to keep this car alive and nice and beautiful looking for 12 years. It's interesting, we in a subscription model like ours, we theoretically do not have to disclose to the customer the mileage of the car or the age of the car, right?
Okay.
Nor do we think it's relevant to people anymore. Over time, I think people, as long as the seating comfort is fine, right? As long as the environment is clean. And that's the same how our airline ticket purchase behavior is. Number one, I never ask what frame I'm sitting in, whether it's an Airbus or a Boeing plane. And number two, I only get comfortable. It can be a 30-year-old plane as long as the interior is updated and clean and I sit in a clean seat and it looks kind of nice. Then I don't worry how old the frame outside is, right?
Right, yeah. Don't check the placard as you walk in the door.
Exactly. Yes, there. I do. I still have this bad habit, yeah?
Yeah, well, I spent 9 years in the airline business, so I know.
Yes, you know, right? I always, when I walk in, I can't resist to check it. And sometimes they're old planes, but they're inside refurbished. And, you know, you get a nice seat. And at the end of the day, you don't necessarily worry about it or care, right?
Yep.
And our view is, in a subscription model, people obviously want to have clean cars. They want to have cars that don't look dated. And then obviously, and that's also led to us to have an outside skin on plastic and glass only. So it's thermoplastic, which you know from your bumpers. And we can foil that thermoplastic. So we can refoil this car. On the thermoplastic, the benefit is there's no dings that you get from parking your car too close to somebody else, because the thermoplastic will always bend back, right?
Yep.
We produce it in white and black, and then we can foil it in any color the customer wants. And once the car, let's say, comes back and gets replaced into another subscriber, it's very easy to refurbish this car.
Okay.
Very, very easy.
Very cool. A lot of thought went into it. So what do you expect sort of the typical subscription to be, like a year, month to month? How do you sort of envision that happening?
So that's very important. In order to get around dealer franchise law, right, it cannot be something that looks, walks, and smells like a lease, which is defined as a finite time contract. Right.
Ah, okay.
It also cannot be a rental, which is a short, finite contract.
Right.
So at the end of the day, in a subscription, there is no time limit. It's you join the subscription. Yeah, you have the right to exit already after 1 month if you don't like it. There's no you pay a subscription fee, but then you just pay your monthly fee. Let's say after a month you said no, this is really not for me. You just walk away from it. Right. You pay your monthly fee. You lose your initial subscription fee, but that's it. the idea was that the young generation, they don't want to commit, right? I think today's life is all about dating. It's not about marrying, right?
Yes,
And
yes.
and a purchase of a car or a longer-term lease for me is like a marriage, right?
Yes.
Because you're committing, right? And young people do not want to commit. And that's why our subscription model is that it doesn't have an end date. You become member of our club, if you so will. You pay your monthly dues. You use your vehicle as long as you want. If after 2 months you don't like it, you can leave. Or if after 10 years you still want to be in, you can be in for 10 years. There's
right.
no time limit.
Right. Now, I would assume that you're probably going to, well, maybe you can also talk, if you can, I don't know if you've set this up yet, if you can sort of talk about what the pricing of that's going to be, but then also sort of how, where this is going to start. I assume maybe LA area, and then from there go to, you know, Chicago and Dallas instead
yeah.
of the bigger cities. So maybe yeah. talk a little bit about that.
So it will start in, our view was it's easier to start it in a EV-friendly market, which
yes.
definitely San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Seattle are, right?
Right.
I think the West Coast in the United States, I think here we find a lot of young people who would love to drive electric if it's affordable, right? And to test out this model, we will start from the U.S. And then, you know, we have selected, that's also the other focus area, we have only selected 37 mega cities in the world that in
okay.
our view are suitable for this type of thing. And we don't look at markets anymore in terms of countries. We look at markets in terms of these mega cities. And what we're observing in these mega cities, first, of course, regulation. Sometimes that's a good thing, you know, in this industry right now that the regulator are on your side. You know, when I was in banking, the regulator was on the opposite side of the table.
Yes, we
in electric cars, the regulator.
We could go
you,
into
you
very
know that,
interesting
right?
conversation
yes,
about Deutsche Bank right
yeah.
now.
Yes, exactly. So there, the regulator was always on the other side of the table. And in this case, obviously, many of the cities, the regulator is on our side of the table, right? They do want to support EVs, they incentivize EVs, so we are selecting then all other cities after the West Coast in the United States. We would just select cities based on the support and the suitability and the interest of customers and the willingness of customers and obviously charging infrastructure and things like that to then introduce step by step in every one of these cities our subscription model. So more of a city-by-city approach than country-by-country approach.
Okay. Do you have a sort of a figure in mind? Can you share that, or are you going to release that at a later date?
And the pricing, we're going to release it at a later date, but
okay.
I can tell you, you can make the assumption that just the fact that we depreciate much less, right?
Right.
We then don't have it, and the second effect is we don't have a dealer margin to worry about because we deliver these cars direct to consumers, right? It's a very different sales process. We will not need dealerships, no brick and mortar, etc. So we also save about 20% of the MSRP. So you can see the amortization piece in our monthly payment will be very small versus a traditional car, significantly smaller.
Okay.
We will, if you think about if you depreciate straight line a car over 10 or 12 years, let's make it easy, in 10 years, you only depreciate 25% of the value in the first 2 years, and obviously on a lease you depreciate much more, right?
Yes.
And therefore you can assume that the monthly payment will be very competitive. We are obviously now discussing to add everything else. We want to make it as convenient as possible. So your registration, title, insurance, and all of this is available to you. Your charging is included, so you really only pay a monthly fee, and everything else is included. We have a little bit of a problem that in the perception that people have, if they think that they're paying $299 lease, that they feel that that's the whole entire car cost.
Yeah,
they generally no. forget that they have to gas and oil and repair and register and insure this car. So normally your monthly payments are much, much higher. So we have to probably do some optical pricing. The main reason we're not releasing a price right now is the insurance component that's
yes.
being negotiated. It's not so difficult. Obviously, there are insurance, you know, there are fleet insurances out there. Fleet insurances is something companies have done, and we are trying now also with this different car to get to a good competitive insurance, which should be possible. And the special an electric car needs much less maintenance than a combustion engine car. That will be also a driver to reduce the price. And then obviously charging is much less expensive than buying gasoline for your car. And generally there's incentives on your titling and registration. So if you look at all the components that will go into our price, you can assume that we probably end up somewhere half of what your true vehicle costs are with a comparable 35,000 to 40,000 combustion engine vehicle will be.
Okay, very good. How are you planning on sort of vetting your subscribers? Obviously, you want, you know, people that are going to be responsible in driving the cars and, you know, when they get ready to turn them back. I mean, these were the concerns I was thinking about when I was looking at this model. What? How do you plan on sort of vetting them then?
Well, the good news is you keep the vehicle, and number one, in today's world, and if you look at the comparable Airbnb business, right? I think initially if somebody told me the notion that I'll have people living in my house, and then I had similar concerns about how they're going to treat my house, et cetera, et cetera. And you've seen that just the fact if people feel a little bit observed, if they're being rated, right, if they're being evaluated, people are a little bit more careful, right, than okay. with a rental car. Obviously, the data that we always have is people don't normally wash their rental car, right, and they normally don't treat their rental car very well.
Right.
But that's because they feel unobserved to some extent. And I think what the Airbnb system has shown, or similar on the Uber, right, where you get points, et cetera, you can influence behaviors of people around maintaining assets in a proper manner, especially if they see the benefit to be part of the subscription, and don't want to lose the rights to the subscription, then we believe people will take care of the car. And if you don't, then obviously you will be excluded from subscription. The car, in today's world, we do have some data about the car. We know exactly how the car was used. There's data if the car was driven on improper roads. There will be data if the car was treated very poorly, like driven against curbside and things like that. But I think that, regretfully, with us human beings, if people feel a little bit observed, then they'll behave differently and they'll care more about the asset than if they feel that they're not observed, right? So
yes.
I think that's the principle that Uber has applied. That's the principle that Airbnb has applied, and therefore I think they are quite successful. You know, of course, from time to time you will have an issue with a customer, but then you can exclude them, like you do in Airbnb. You can just exclude them from participating
in the
benefit of a subscription.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. When do you expect to launch?
21. Mid 21, yeah.
All right. So I assume where is the car going to be produced?
Well, this is both will be initially produced in the United States. That's the company is still in final negotiations for that. There's been site selected. There's a contract manufacturer selected, but we haven't talked about this yet publicly.
Okay. Well, I understand there's about 4 GM plants that would be available.
Yeah, the issue only with these old plants sometimes is are they located in the right place,
yes.
and things like that, right? And at the end of the day, the way that our vehicle build is so different to a combustion engine. We, for example, don't have a paint booth like a combustion engine vehicle plant has today. And therefore, at the end of the day, the building may be interesting because it's a sizable building, but there's, as we saw, buildings for other uses that will do the same because the plant equipment is quite different to produce this type of a car than what...
So what you're going to have, if I understand, you've got probably some type of a metal chassis and frame that goes over that, and then that gets a plastic exterior with a...
Yeah.
Vinyl wrap of some type?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And the glass, right? So
the glass
top, the top is all glass, and the bottom is this thermoplastic material, and then it gets wrapped. And that can be, the cabin can be produced in parallel while the skateboard, the chassis gets produced. Yeah. So for example, the famous marriage in a car plant, which in a combustion engine car is when the engine goes into the body of the car. In our case, happens much later when we just stick the cabin on top of the chassis, right? So it's just a different way. So it's much faster. It's about 30% faster to produce a canoe car than a traditional combustion engine car. And it's just a different production path.
Yeah, I can see that. That would and the skateboard sort of allows you to even maybe consider different form factors that would sit on top of that. Then I would assume.
Which that's what's currently in the making. There's four different vehicles in the making that sit exactly on the identical chassis. And for that, obviously, the core was that we needed a steer-by-wire system, yeah, so we don't have a steering wheel that sits in a certain and therefore defines the position of the driver. And so we developed this steer-by-wire system. So our steering wheel can be placed anywhere in the vehicle, which then allows you to develop very different top heads on top, where a driver sits further forward or further backward or further in the middle or further to the side. Because our steering wheel can be put anywhere in the car, right-hand drive, left-hand drive. We just can move the steering wheel around in the vehicle wherever we want. And that created then this high feasibility to really create very different cabins on top of the exactly identical skateboard. So 70% of our cars in terms of value and technology is always the same. And then 30% is then in the top heads and it's different.
Right. What sort of? Of course, one of the practical issues, if you're appealing to a younger city audience, one of the problems in these big cities is they live in apartments and there's little or no provisions to charge these vehicles. So, from a practical point of view, how are you thinking about addressing that?
Yeah. So. Generally, the charging infrastructure in these cities has improved quite a bit, right? So generally, we see that wherever you shop, wherever you go eating, or when you wherever you work, right, the charging infrastructure has to grow. Grow. It is a challenge. You absolutely say in multi-tenant apartment buildings that sometimes is a challenge. That's certainly a problem that we will not probably be able to solve. That's why, to be honest, a city like Los Angeles is better because most people live still in homes, instead of apartment buildings. That's why the European cities are a little bit more challenging for electric cars, right? Or Manhattan is more challenging for electric cars. And that's what we. That's why when I talked about our city selection, obviously this is a big driver. China is doing quite a good job to really create public infrastructure on roadside parking, Europe has this big challenge. Most of the cars in America are parked in a driveway overnight. Most of the cars in Europe are parked on the roadside overnight, right? And therefore, we need roadside charging. We hope that induction charging will come to these cities over time. But we are still some ways away to be at the point where the infrastructure is perfect. That's certainly one of the challenges we have.
Right.
But I always remind people when we started with the combustion age, you had to go to, in Germany, when Mr. Daimler drove his Mercedes around, he had to go into a pharmacy to buy gasoline, right? And today we have a well-built infrastructure. I think this is just over time, these cities will adjust. And I think you will just have charging on roadside.
One of the things. Yeah, one of the things, a couple related to this is that, what are your thoughts regarding autonomous driving where maybe in the middle of the night the car can go dispatch itself to a central charging facility and charge itself up and then drive back to from the sort of extension of the summons mode. And then the other part of this would be, are there any provisions for the subscriber to, pardon the expression, sublet if the vehicle, if it's sitting outside of an office building during the day?
So what we have developed is, I think what our main thought was is there is today cities you have a large what I call the public network that's run by companies, charging companies or Tesla or et cetera. But then there's so many private chargers, people at their homes, at their drivers putting charging in place. And that's why we looked into this blockchain application, because if I put in a charger in my garage, in my apartment building, and I could, you know, have other people charge and I can make some money while they charge their cars, then I'm going to be a little bit like Lime and all these scooter companies are doing. I can now rely on the private network as well, right? And then I can have more people install this because they can make money with it. So, for example, at my house, I have in the driveway, I have a charger, and during the whole day, I'm not using it because I'm in the office. So I wouldn't mind if any of my neighbors just drive up to my driveway and plug in their car, as long as I get paid for it, right? And
yes.
As long as reliable the payment.
Yeah.
And that's what blockchain is going to be able to do for us, right? That it's going to be very easy to identify the driver, the car, and the charging station, and that's some testing we're doing already, to then open up the entire private network and entice people to privately invest into chargers because they'll be able to make money. Imagine then a restaurant that can start charging for charging will use the parking lot for chargers as well. Will then be much more open to do their investment and become a charging entrepreneur. So I think that's what we have to do. That will be certainly a big incentive to just create more people making charging available.
Oh, great. So you've given this a great deal of thought, and I really appreciate you taking 50 minutes with me today to talk about these things.
Okay. Yes.
It's really been good to talk, and I'd like to sort of keep this this dialogue going, because you know, as I explained, I'm exploring this from the point of view of, you know, using some of these off lease cars, which you've, you know, alluded to. We're in the Midwest. We're not quite as advanced as the coasts are with respect to EV adoption. Although just about any time I drive now, I'll see a Tesla on the road anymore. So that's exciting to see. But I'd love to stay in touch with you and look for opportunities to maybe collaborate.
Yes, perfect.
Excellent.
That would be great. Yeah,
all right,
thank you
good.
So much.
Steph,
all the
thank
best.
You so
yeah,
much.
Thank you.
All right. Wiedersehen.
Okay. Bye-bye. Wiedersehen.
You've been listening to an EV World Future in Motion podcast with your host, Bill Moore. Be sure to follow me on Twitter and learn more about the exciting world of electric vehicles on evworld.com. This has been an EV World production. All rights reserved.